The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort, meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
Hello and welcome to The Price of Football, the pod that looks at the money behind the beautiful game, with me, Kevin Day, and expert in football finance at Liverpool University, Kieran Maguire. But before anything, this is the pod that says happy birthday to the Baroness.
Thank you very much. On behalf of her, as always, she doesn't listen to the show because she's scared of what I might say.
Yes, and it was very sweet that you sent me the restaurant from the posh... you sent me the restaurant. That, when we start getting paid, you'll send me the restaurant. You sent me the menu from the posh restaurant, which I'm fairly sure you only took her to because one of the starters was salted plums.
I can't possibly comment.
See, I know, the trouble is you send me a picture of the menu with salted plums on it, and then I have to tell Ali while I'm laughing. Then her eyebrows go up, then my eyebrows go up, and then Kieran, it's questions day, and we do have a lot of questions to ask you. And this week, it seems that some of our listeners are trying to break the record for world's longest question.
Yes,
a couple of news items first. Former Wigan Athletic owner Al Young has agreed to waive the £36 million owed to him by the club. I really hope, Kieran, he's not looking for a round of applause off the back of that.
Well, no, but the best way I can describe this is it's a diamond in a cesspit as far as his ownership of the club is concerned. And it's still as baffling as ever, but it does potentially give the club a greater chance of avoiding a further 15-point penalty next season, because under EFL rules, if you don't give your unsecured creditors 25% of what is owed to them, you do get another quite severe penalty to have to deal with. So the creditors of Wigan Athletic, they were £46 million, of which £36 million was owned to effectively Al Young through the National Leader Fund and WA Holdings. Now, he's written that off, so that drops the creditors to £10 million. So instead of having to get 25% of £46 million, the administrators, when they sell the club, they need to get enough money to be able to pay 25% of £10 million. So that is a step in the right direction in terms of another potential points deduction next season.
So this is possibly a rare act of decency from Al Young, then, is it?
It is. It's still baffling as to why he, A, bought the club in the first place, given that we established he was already talking about putting it into administration as soon as he owned it, and then writing off £36 million a couple of months later. Nobody in their right minds would do this. I'm sure the bloke's not stupid. So, yeah, as we've said on many occasions, there is more to this than meets the eye.
Yeah, and I'm fairly certain that this will be a subject we're probably talking about this time next season. And we're going to talk about it a little more now, because we heard this week, Kieran, that the EFL has released its commission rulings into the Wigan, Sheffield Wednesday and Birmingham City cases. And you spoke to Tom Horton, a QC from Football Law, to get all the details. And here's what he had to say.
That's right. I mean, so Tom was really good to us. He's not a QC though. Apparently, I got that wrong. He described himself as just a lowly barrister, and I thought a lowly barrister was the ones that worked in Starbucks. So I'm not quite sure where he is in the pecking order, but he's certainly a lot smarter than you or I.
If I had a hat, Kieran, I'd be taking it off to you for that pun. That was See, and also it just proves what I've always said: you can work clean, Kieran. You can work clean. So listen, let's hear. I'm also taking exception to the fact that he's cleverer than you or I. He's a made up QC. You're a made up professor of football finance. So, and I'm a fully qualified pub expert on many things. So let's have a listen to what he said.
Hi, Thomas, or Tom, shall perhaps call you, as it's a Saturday. Welcome to the show. How are you doing today?
I'm very well, thank you. And thanks so much for having me on. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome. You're welcome. And you know, as you're probably aware, Kevin and I are both pub lawyers, which works at times. You know, we've got certain rules, such as we change the owners and directors test to "Are you a wrong'un?" Which I suspect, as somebody with a QC after their letters, after their name, you'd probably say could be a little bit more difficult to prove.
I'm not a QC, Kieran, which is one thing to bear in mind. I noted Kevin had given me that promotion in the last show. I am, I suppose, a lowly junior barrister, focusing or looking to focus on sports law and football law in particular. And I say it's something that I've sort of been focusing on now for the past couple of years. And earlier this year, I launched footballlaw.co.uk, which has had a good reception so far. I've been commenting on the most recent news stories, whether it be sort of disciplinary commission decisions, or, for example, takeovers I've been rumbling on or not coming to fruition. So, yeah, it's been over the past sort of 5 months where I've really put myself out there in terms of football law, but it's something that I've been building up my knowledge on now for the past couple of years.
Fantastic, fantastic. Well, I mean, there was 121 pages. I counted them up. Appeared on the EFL website in the last week or so. I think it was last Monday morning. It dropped at 10 a.m. I guess the main charges that fans have been focusing on this week have been in respect of Sheffield Wednesday. There were two charges, one of which was proven effectively and one was not proven. Could you sort of summarise for our listeners as to the reasons why one went one way and one went the other way as far as the club was concerned?
Sure. So the first charge against Sheffield Wednesday related to the sale of Hillsborough, which I know has been talked about numerous times on the show before, and in particular whether or not the sale of Hillsborough should have been included in Sheffield Wednesday's accounts for the year ending 2018. In summary, that charge was proved. The stadium sale should not have been in the accounts for the year ending 2018. The issue for the Independent Disciplinary Commission was whether or not assertions that had been made by the EFL in respect of that stadium sale gave rise to a legitimate expectation on Sheffield Wednesday's behalf that it could be included in the accounts for the year ending 2018. And another reason why Sheffield Wednesday has put it into the accounts for the year ending 2018 were because there'd been an email from somebody at the EFL, which essentially said that if the auditors approve of this, then yes, it can be included in those year ending 2018 accounts. But one of the difficulties was, or that came to fruition from the written reasons of the Disciplinary Commission, was that the auditors, when they gave the effective sign-off in respect of including the sale in the year-ending 2018 accounts, they didn't seek any legal advice about the terms upon which the stadium sale was based. And likewise, nor did the officials of Sheffield Wednesday seek any legal advice about the basis for that sale as well. And what Sheffield Wednesday had effectively done was, after the 31st of July 2018, realised that they needed to sell the stadium, but that it needed to be accounted for before the 31st of July 2018. So they effectively tried to enter into a heads of terms agreement for that sale of the stadium with an effective date before the 31st of July 2018. Now, there was some, or it was put forward by Sheffield Wednesday to the Disciplinary Commission, that there might be some complex way around of formulating some sort of document. but in essence, it wasn't a legally binding document that they entered into. And that was a big pitfall in respect of Sheffield Wednesday's position. And on the back of that as well, because of this erroneous understanding by the auditors giving permission in how the stadium was supposed to be accounted for, the Disciplinary Commission said that if the EFL was bound by that erroneous decision of the auditors, then essentially the EFL would always be bound by errors made by an independent third party. And that's just not right. And also, above that too, the EFL's regulations require football clubs' accounts to comply with specific requirements, either legally or regulatory. And by including the sale in the year-ending 2018 accounts, that hadn't been satisfied. So that was in respect of that legitimate expectation issue. And insofar as anyone at the EFL said that Sheffield Wednesday can do that as well, it was stated by the Disciplinary Commission that the officers of the EFL involved didn't have the authority to change the EFL regulations, which, as I said, required the company's accounts to comply with legal and regulatory requirements. Although that does raise the issue of if those officers did have the authority, could the accounts then have been complied without compliance with those legal and regulatory requirements? And that might be something that's being raised in the appeal, which Sheffield Wednesday are making. And then in respect of another defence from under this charge, which is quite an interesting or quite nuanced point, was that because that first element had been proved, that the annual accounts weren't done properly, Sheffield Wednesday then submitted, well, in theory then, no actual or proper annual accounts has been submitted as defined in the regulations. And as that's a requirement for the EFL to refer matters for misconduct hearings, that qualification hasn't been met, and therefore it was premature for these disciplinary proceedings to be issued. However, that argument was given fairly short shrift by the Disciplinary Commission, as it essentially tried to make the regulations unworkable or try to make them absent of any meaningful enforcement within a reasonable period. So that was in respect of charge one. And that's what has resulted in the sanction against Sheffield Wednesday. In respect of charge two, this was a bit more of a serious allegation. And this was in respect of whether or not Sheffield Wednesday had deliberately concealed from the EFL the terms of that heads of terms agreement that I referred to earlier, in respect of it being backdated to before the 1st of July 2018. Now, the EFL noted originally that when they started looking at this charge and all the evidence, that if the EFL is going to allege that someone has been dishonest, they should do more than just say that they are concerned. They should make an outright allegation against those involved. And above that as well, in order to make any such allegation, the EFL should really have some convincing evidence to support it from the off. And it was also noted as well that the officials from Sheffield Wednesday involved, they hadn't even been given the chance to be investigated or properly interviewed by the EFL before this charge of dishonesty was made against them. The reasoning in respect of this charge, which ultimately resulted in the charge not being established, those from Sheffield Wednesday were very relieved to find out, focused really on a meeting that had taken place between Sheffield Wednesday and the EFL back in August of 2018. Now, at this point, that heads of term agreement hadn't actually been finalised. As I've said, it was entered on a later date after that 3rd of August meeting, but it was backdated. And what the EFL were essentially saying was that at that meeting on the 3rd of August 2018, Sheffield Wednesday or its officials had concealed the information that this heads of term agreement had been entered and had been backdated. However, it hadn't been entered at that time. It was something that was done after the 3rd of August 2018. And also the email correspondence and contemporaneous notes from that meeting that the disciplinary commission considered resulted in the disciplinary commission finding it difficult to accept that Sheffield Wednesday did conceal or would have had to have concealed anything from the EFL. So it was dealt with very convincingly, but it did raise a lot of criticism against the EFL for dealing with such a serious allegation in a fairly lackadaisical manner. And you really should have some, you know, significant evidence before you if you're going to allege that someone's being dishonest. So that was those were the two charges, and say the first one was proven, the second one was not so.
That's great. I mean, because I'm aware that the EFL did have charges against Mr. Chancery, Catherine Meir, and the finance director earlier in the year, and they were dismissed. So for me, as a layman, it seems, well, given that the senior officials at the club have been found innocent of the allegations, why then pursue the club? Because looking at the report from the IDC, it appears to hint that if the EFL had simply focused upon the issue of the sale of the stadium, then a decision could have been made a lot quicker. Is that the case, or am I misunderstanding things?
No, that's absolutely correct. And so there were two decisions released from the EFL last week. One of them dealt with the charges in particular, then the second one dealt with the sanction to be applied for Sheffield Wednesday's breach or the charge one that was proved. And part of the reasoning behind the Disciplinary Commission's decision to impose a 12-point deduction effective from next season was indeed what you've just said, in that this charge two, which wasn't proved and which, you know, the Disciplinary Commission were critical of the EFL in respect of, didn't really need to have been made until the EFL had done proper investigations on their behalf. Their regulations allow them to have pretty extensive investigatory procedures completed before a charge is even issued, but they didn't do that. And that was one of the factors which resulted in the charges firstly not being made until November 2019, but then also the general evidential considerations and legal arguments in respect of charge two just added generally to the whole timescale of the matter. And what the Disciplinary Commission said was that, you know, but for charge two being brought, the matter could have been dealt with much sooner, albeit there would have been some delay, perhaps potentially with COVID, I'm not sure. But that was certainly one of the criticisms against the EFL and one of the factors in the Disciplinary Commission's mind when making a decision on the appropriate sanction. And like you say, Zon, in respect to those individual charges being dropped earlier on, what the Disciplinary Commission noted in respect of charge two nonetheless was that although you're bringing it against the club and not an individual, in essence, you are bringing it against the individuals because they're the ones that make the decisions of the club.
Yes. Okay. Cool. I mean, just a couple of other things, which is what I picked up. And again, you know, I'll be the first to stress I am a layperson. There was no reference from what I could make out with regards to the value of Hillsborough. So should we take from that that the £60 million sale price has been accepted effectively by the Commission and by the EFL when they're doing their next set of calculations? And secondly, something I picked up, that there appeared to be some sort of relationship between Sheffield Wednesday and Derby in the sense that they were sort of sharing evidence. Is that usual for a case of this nature?
So in respect to the valuation of the stadium, as you've again noted, very detailed reading, Kieran, there was no criticism of the using this method of selling a stadium to generate revenue or profit for a club. This is an accepted practice, and that's something that was noted a couple of times throughout both written reasons. And then in respect to the valuation of Hillsborough, there was no criticism of that at all as well. So I'd be surprised if there's going to be anything further in respect of that actual specific transaction and, you know, it firstly taking place and also the value of it as well. The second point that you've mentioned in respect of Sheffield Wednesday and Derby County sort of being in each other's ears, it's an interesting point. And what the Disciplinary Commission said in its written reasons in respect of imposing the sanction is that they don't pass any comment on the appropriateness of the two clubs doing that. And I don't think there's anything really that prohibits the clubs from speaking to each other and sharing that information. And even if an argument was to be raised against it, it would essentially be undermined by, well, if the EFL, I'll get to what was discussed in a moment, but if the EFL are essentially going to release this line of attack and it's going to be evident from the written reasons, then there's no harm, and those written reasons will be publicly available eventually. There's no harm in those clubs discussing what's going on. And what was going on in particular was that in respect of Derby County, which I'm sure the listeners will be aware of, they're facing very similar charges to what Sheffield Wednesday have faced in respect of the sale of Pride Park. And in that case, if the EFL are successful in establishing the charges against Derby County, what has been discovered is that the EFL are not going to be looking to impose a sanction to be effective from the just finished 2019-20 season, but we'll be looking for a sanction to be imposed in the 2021 season. Now, Sheffield Wednesday, being made aware of this from Derby County, finding out about it, use this reasoning as a line of attack before the Disciplinary Commission to say, well, any sanction that's going to be imposed on us likewise shouldn't be imposed in the 2019-2020 season, which should be in the 2021 season. And it was something that was validly accepted as a consideration by the Disciplinary Commission. So it's interesting to see the two clubs speaking to each other. I don't think there's anything that prohibits it as well.
Okay, cool. Well, that's pretty comprehensive. I really appreciate that. The EFL photocopier was clearly very busy on Monday morning, because not only did we have the reports out on Sheffield Wednesday, and you've got to give credit to all the parties involved for the transparency here, in my view. You know, I'm a great believer in giving credit where it's due and stick where it's due. So fair play to the EFL and the clubs involved. We also had a ruling in respect of Birmingham, where they were effectively found guilty of not sticking to a budget, and the sanctions against them was a finger wagging. Is that a fair summary?
Absolutely, a finger wagging, a slap on the wrist, whichever way you want to put it. It wasn't much when you compare it to, you know, point sanctions and fines that are otherwise available. This whole dispute between the EFL and Birmingham City has its roots back in August of 2018. And it wasn't until June of 2020 when this final, you know, decision was delivered that there's been some sort of conclusivity on it or conclusion on it. What it brought down to, as you said, that there was this business plan that was entered between the EFL and Birmingham City, which had, in essence, four conditions attached to it, which required Birmingham City to, through the sale of registered players, to make cost savings of just over £10.5 million. And that was to be completed by the 1st of February 2019. So that budget plan was entered on the 1st of August 2018, and the deadline for compliance was the 1st of February 2019, which essentially meant that Birmingham City only had the January transfer window to comply with this sale of players to generate savings of just over £10.5 million. They didn't comply with that amount by February 2019, but come July 2019, when they sold Shay Adams, although that's not explicitly referred to in the decision, it's kind of obvious when you piece it all together in news stories. When they sold Shay Adams, in terms of player sales, they made that cost saving. But in addition to that as well, I think in May 2019, they'd sold their St Andrews, or whatever it's called now, for
the Trillium Trophy Stadium, as I'm sure fans are love singing about that.
I think that's the only trophy that Birmingham City might have as well, bar one.
You've just lost a few followers in the Midlands there, Thomas.
You saw a healthy band, so it was fine. So they also sold their stadium, which generated, I think, is about £17 million worth of profit for them. But as I say, the cost saving was meant to be made by way of player sales. But regardless of how it was done, the deadline was the 1st of February 2019. That wasn't met. And therefore, the EFL brought charges of misconduct against Birmingham City because they hadn't stuck to that business plan. At first instance, Birmingham City said and successfully argued that in complying with that condition to sell certain other players to make a £10.5 million cost saving by the 1st of February 2019, Birmingham City only had to exercise what's known as reasonable endeavours. So that's not like a second best. It's, you know, doing your best to comply with that condition. And there was quite a lot of legal discussion in that first instance decision. But the Disciplinary Commission agreed with Birmingham that that implied condition did take effect to the selling of players by 1st of February 2019. And considering that Birmingham City had sold some players, albeit it didn't amount to the £10.5 million that was needed, that Birmingham City were essentially in a buyer's market to the detriment of Birmingham City, that the EFL had, for example, sent around a media release to chair people of other championship clubs saying that Birmingham City were under some business plan, which is essentially a red flag saying Birmingham City need to sell all their players, come and get them really cheap. That was an issue as well that was considered. And Birmingham City, as I say, avoided any sanction at the first instance on that basis. However, the EFL then appealed against that decision, firstly saying that the best endeavours requirement shouldn't be applied to this budget plan. And secondly, even if there was best endeavours anyway, Birmingham City hadn't done that. And one of the big differentiating factors when it came to the appeal being heard was that there'd been an error in terms of evidence from that first instance decision and the appeals decision, and most notably in respect of Shay Adams. What Birmingham City had said at first instance was that they would have, even if they'd sold Shay Adams in January 2019 for the best offer that they received then, they still would not have reached that £10.5 million requirement under the budget. What came to fruition in the appeal was actually there was an offer in January 2019 which would have resulted in Birmingham City reaching that £10.5 million odd target. And that was a significant factor against Birmingham City because it essentially meant, in short, that they could have complied with the business plan. So that was something that went against them. The legal reasoning at first instance was undermined and the implied term didn't apply in any event. But then, which makes this all seem a bit of a storm in a teacup for how much, you know, litigation there has been in respect of it, because Birmingham City did, albeit later on in the year, comply with the budget and also complied with the profitability and sustainability rules generally as well, that militated against there being a harsh sanction imposed. And therefore, the appropriate sanction from the appeals board perspective was simply a reprimand. One qualification to that is that although it appears to be a huge storm in a teacup insofar as that punishment is concerned, but the one real issue that the EFL wanted to get clarified by way of the appeal was that any implied term of best endeavours shouldn't apply to any kind of business plan that is agreed between the club and the EFL to try and get that club to comply with the profitability and sustainability rules in the future. So that was the real reason, from what I could gather, why that appeal was made, albeit that the sanction imposed at the end of it all just seems a bit underwhelming, I suppose.
So effectively, if the EFL comes to a similar agreement with a club or a similar proposal for a club in terms of a business plan to reduce losses or to cut costs or whatever, that will now effectively be binding on clubs in future activities. Is that correct?
Yes, that's exactly the reason that's given from the appeal decision, yep.
Yeah, well, I mean, I guess that does get some clarity then. But I mean, it must be costing the AFL a fortune, all of this. And then finally, and I'll try and keep it brief. You know, I've myself and Kevin have both had connections with Wigan Athletic. Their 12-point deduction. Now, to me, whilst the moral issues we have to park here, to me that always seemed a pretty black and white decision to make on behalf of the EFL. So was it a fairly foregone conclusion that Wigan's appeal was going to fail?
I think so. And it's something that I wrote about before the written reasons and the announcement of the decision was made that Wigan had been unsuccessful. Purely because, so there's two things to bear in mind. The 12-point deduction effective in the 2019-2020 season was mandatory. The rules expressly state that because the administration occurred on X date, the 12-point deduction has to apply in this season. The only basis upon which you can appeal that, and I think this has been mentioned on the show before as well, is if the club could establish that there was a force majeure event, which is a defined term in the EFL regulations. And the way that it's worded and the circumstances upon which Wigan were relying, which essentially seemed to be that COVID happened, can we get off the hook, was not going to fall within that definition. That's a very summative way of putting it, or a reductive way of putting it, but in essence, that was it. And it was always going to be difficult for Wigan to overcome that force majeure threshold. And unfortunately for them, I have the greatest sympathy for what the fans and the club, of course, have been going through. It was always going to be difficult for them to overturn it. And I don't think there's been any, overturning of such a deduction before as well. So not saying the writing was on the wall, but it was. And I think as well, one point to take away from the 12-point deduction in Wigan in comparison to the Sheffield Wednesday case and the 12-point deduction there, it created some confusion because not everyone was familiar with the mandatory points deduction in Wigan's case, yeah, and then the essentially discretionary sanction that could be imposed by the Disciplinary Commission in the Sheffield Wednesday case, which allowed for the commission to apply reasoning and consider sanctioning guidelines and other circumstances as to why that 12-point deduction against Sheffield Wednesday should take effect from next season rather than the season just finished or even the season before that as well.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, yeah, as far as I'm concerned, as somebody that used to work in the insolvency world, you're either in administration or you're not. You know, it's a bit like you're either dead or you're not dead. You know, it is a fairly black and white issue. Yeah. So, you know, I can understand from the perspective of the administrators, you know, they're trying to sell the club and clearly they'll have a much better chance of selling the club at a higher price if it's a championship club. But you know, I did feel that setting aside all of the curiosity, and I think that's where the main issues are in respect of Wigan, especially given the latest we're hearing in terms of Mr. Al Young deciding to write off the debts that are due to him from the club. I think that's where the fascination lies. But whether we'll ever get to the bottom of that story is another matter. But I'd just like to say, Thomas, thank you so much for giving up your time. I know you're about to go on holiday, so yeah, I'm sure you're busy with your bucket and spade and things of that nature as well. So yeah, I know it can't be easy for you. If listeners want to find you on social media and things of that nature, where's the best place to look?
Thanks so much, Kieran. So yeah, I'm on Twitter. It's @thefootballlaw, or you can head to the website, which is www.footballlaw.co.uk, and there's overviews on the website of FIFA, UEFA, the Premier League, the EFL. But I also write articles regularly as well, as I mentioned at the beginning, discussing the most recent football law news and decisions.
Brilliant, brilliant. And just out of interest, who do you support?
Aston Villa, of course.
Ah, right. Ah, right. Oh, well, so you're not too worried about losing too many Birmingham City fans anyway.
Precisely.
Superb. Thank you so much, Thomas. Have a great holiday and thanks again for your time.
Thanks, Kieran. All the best. Bye.
The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place. That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient, comfortable. Ah.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
So that's all. I mean, basically, to precede that, Kieran, he said the Sheffield Wednesday one was the wrong case. Birmingham got a slap on the wrist, and Wigan were never going to win because rules trump morality, essentially.
That's right, Kevin. I think you have summed it up perfectly. And I think if you were in the legal profession, you wouldn't last very long because they get paid by the word. and you've managed to very succinctly summarise it in about 15 seconds.
Yes, yes. And I believe what I took from that as well is that he's not convinced that your idea of an EFL wrong'uns test is actually better than what they've got at the moment.
No, I'm slightly disappointed about that because we did put a lot of thought onto this, onto the back of a beer mat, and our two-question approach, A, are you a wrong'un, and B, do you have a mate called Big Dave, we were convinced
Absolutely.
Would get rid of all inappropriate people from the game.
Yeah. Also, I don't think you should be allowed to call it a beer mat. You're a teetotaler, so get your own mat. Right, questions. So we've got some very good questions today, and the first is about the league's oldest club. Laurie, Eagle, Scott, James D and Jedi all turned to us after a massive argument on Twitter amongst themselves for an answer to the Alexander Sherlock conundrum. Now, he plays currently for Trabzonspor. He's the winner of Turkey's Golden Boot. He's been linked with a move to RB Leipzig and Barcelona. But the trouble is, he's on a two-year loan from Crystal Palace. There's no recall clause, obviously. And Trabzonspor haven't taken up the €6 million option to buy. So how can he move to another club in those circumstances?
Well, I think without seeing the small print of his loan arrangement with Crystal Palace, we've got to be a little bit cautious here. It would be potentially possible for Palace to buy him out of the second year of his loan arrangement. And there is a precedent for this in the case of somebody called Alexis McAllister, who is, to my knowledge, the only ginger Argentinian international ever to wear the number 10 shirt for the Argentinian national team. Now, Alexis was playing for Argentino's juniors. He was then sold to my club, Brighton, for around about £7 million. But because he didn't have a work permit, he couldn't play in the Premier League. So we then loaned him back to Boca Juniors until he got an Argentinian cap. And then last January, when things were looking a little bit dicky for us, we bought back our own player for £700,000 as a loan fee to buy him back from his original loan. So what Palace could do is that Palace could get into negotiations with Trabzonspor and buy Sorloth back effectively out of his two-year loan fee and then sell him to another club.
Yes, well, I don't understand about this, Kieran. And to be fair, he didn't look like he was going to win the Golden Boot in Turkey when we got rid of him, and not many Palace fans were sad when he went. But I can't understand why any club wouldn't have a recall clause in a loan deal anyway. It just seems common sense.
Well, I'm entirely in agreement with you. And it comes down to, you know, the people at the club, instead of rushing through a deal, perhaps going through every line. And that's why we have club lawyers and so on. And that's why we take legal advice, because, you know, quite often they will spot things of this nature and say, well, hold on. You know, what if he does discover his shooting boots this season? You know, it could have been that Palace might have wanted to recall him in January and were unable to do so because he had been finding the back of the net in Turkey. And, you know, it's not any surprise to anybody. Yet Palace's biggest problem last season was scoring goals. I think they scored 32 goals the whole season. So, you know, he could have been an addition to the front line.
Well, yeah, as could Conor Wickham, who we bizarrely decided to send to Sheffield Wednesday for no apparent reason. I've got a feeling that if Palace do have a club lawyer, Kieran, he probably is called Big Dave, poor sod. Our next question comes from Billy Wakefield. That's a great name, isn't it, Billy Wakefield? That's a proper 60s film name, isn't it? Billy recently went to a work seminar on the Corporate Insolvency and Governance Act of 2020, and he's very keen to stress it was a work seminar. He didn't volunteer for this. He had to go. But Billy's question is, since most clubs are limited companies, will all the relaxation /change in insolvency legislation have a positive impact for clubs in financial peril? And perhaps you probably need to put some meat on those bones and tell us what the relaxation in insolvency legislation is in as few words as possible, please.
Okay. Right. Here I'm indebted to friend of the show, a guy called Scott Bevington, who is an insolvency practitioner. So I had a bit of a conversation with Scott. And to summarise as quickly as possible, there are two potential avenues clubs could go down. First of all, there's a moratorium, which prevents creditors from winding up the club. We're not convinced, or Scott's not convinced, if truth be told, that this would really benefit clubs, although it doesn't seem to be covered by EFL rules. So this is another potential loophole. And secondly, and this is about as middle management and PowerPoint friendly as possible, a restructuring and cross-class cram down rule, which is similar to a CVA, and that could be very useful to clubs because it allows you to put your creditors into separate groups such as staff, trade creditors, banks, and so on. And if you can get 50% of each of those groups to agree, then perhaps you can get a deal through. But the important thing is that the courts can force through these agreements, whereas historically that wasn't the case. So it's all quite technical. But he does think it could be beneficial to clubs, but it would come at a price. I think the cost of administering these are quite significant. We've already seen in relation to Wigan that the administrators' fees, we are potentially we're looking at about £1.3 million, and it's only been in administration a few weeks.
So the moratorium, so a club could request that, presumably. And I need to write down the second one because I was giggling halfway through it because of the alliteration. Cross-class?
A cross-class cram-down.
Cram-down?
Cram-down. It's a new word.
It's a bit WWE, isn't it? Okay, so these are both things that clubs can now suggest possibly to keep them out of trouble, but they will cost a lot of money.
It's effectively a protective bubble for clubs, so could be of some benefit. There's also a couple of temporary measures as a result of the pandemic. So there's no winding up orders allowed until the 30th of September. So that has protected clubs over the course of the summer. And
hello.
We're just at a tap of the. It's my mate Paul delivering some wine for the Baroness.
From what you said earlier, Kieran, it sounds like she doesn't need any more wine delivered. Does the dog not like Paul?
No. The dog loves Paul.
That's an excited bark, is it?
Yes.
Does he bark like that when he sees you?
He gets very squeaky.
I can't remember what your dog's name's called now.
It's called Finley. Finley,
oh, Finley, of course, yeah, Finley.
Yeah, yeah. He's now just run out of the house with one of my training shoes. So winding up orders, there's a moratorium on those, which that gives clubs some protection, but that runs out on the 30th of September. And we've said on a number of occasions that we are in sort of a bit of a phony war with regards to clubs' existence and protection. And with the furlough scheme due to end at the end of October, and these rules, the winding up petitions, the wrongful trading ban on directors, that's suspended till the 30th of September as well. Once these rules return, then we could see more activity in terms of the continued existence of clubs, or rather, you know, the potential for some form of formal or informal insolvency arrangements. So we're okay at present, but yeah. I am getting twitchy.
Okay, well, I'm sorry to that. It's a pessimistic note, isn't it? Our next question is an early contender for the longest question of the pod, but there's no short way to answer this question, really, so I couldn't even find a way to sub it. It's a very good question. It comes from John Castle. And John's question is regarding the corporate structure of Celtic. John says that his understanding is it's made up of three companies. So you've got Celtic PLC, which owns the players, the ground, and the membership of the SPFL. You've got Celtic FC Limited, which is the professional football club, which receives all the gate money, employs and pays all the players and staff, and receives the TV income. And then you've got the Celtic Football and Athletic Company Limited, which was probably set up to preserve and maintain the old name. So John wants to know if he's correct, and if so, why do Celtic set up in this way?
First of all, yes, John is correct. Celtic set up in a similar way to many clubs, in that they put potentially different operations into sort of different silos. So if you take a look at Derby, they've got one company which runs the academy. You've got one company which runs the commercial arm. Manchester United are the same. You might have another company which owns the ground. There are times at football clubs where you might want to sell off the catering, or you might want to sell off the academy or the marketing department. And if it's set up as separate companies, then it's easier from the owner's point of view to deal with that part of the business. In respect of the Celtic Football and Athletic Company, this is the old name, in effect, for Celtic. And the reason why the club has kept on that name is that they don't particularly want that name being picked up by a fan, either of Celtic or even potentially of Rangers. You know, for example, Crystal Palace Football Club no longer exists, as far as I can make out, Limited. So a fan could set that up, and that just causes a bit of confusion. So, you know, if somebody who's not over familiar with Palace and now CPFC 2010 Limited, and you've got Palace Holdco and Palace Midco and so on, that person might reach the wrong conclusions. So by setting up and keeping the old name of the club, even though Celtic Football and Athletic Club is dormant, it just prevents somebody from doing a bit of mischief.
Yes, that all makes perfect sense. But to me, as a non-accountant, it does seem odd, and I'm sure it will do to quite a few people listening, that you've got one part of the company owns the ground and the membership of the SPFL, and another part of the company receives the TV income separately. It seems strange, but from what you're saying, it's not unusual in business or in football.
No. I mean, if you take a look at Newcastle, I think they've got something like 20 subsidiaries.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And because they're connected to Mike Ashley, every single Sports Direct shop is set up as a separate company. So, there is normally either a good legal or a good tax reason behind taking such an approach.
So these three separate companies at Celtic, do they have to produce three separate accounts at the end of the year, or is it still one group set of accounts?
They do have to publish separate accounts. But what happens is a bit like sort of a Matryoshka doll situation. If you're familiar with Russian dolls, they fit inside each other. So what you would do is that you would go into the Celtic PLC accounts, which act as an umbrella, and they contain the numbers of all of the companies added together.
Okay, so now Chris Flavel. Flavel sounds quite Harry Potter, doesn't it? Let's go with Chris Flavel. Chris has got an interesting question for fans of German football and our second mention of RB Leipzig. What are the chances on a pod about finance and football? Very high. Chris asks about Hwang Hee-chan's transfer from RB Salzburg to RB Leipzig. Now, as he says, while this is undoubtedly a well-trodden career move by now, I think 18 players have gone from Salzburg to Leipzig. Why, says Chris, has it not attracted scrutiny from UEFA? Are there examples of deals between the two clubs that don't quite add up? And how do we know that transactions between the two clubs owned by the same person are taking place at market value?
Well, I think Chris's point is a very good one, and this has certainly caused eyebrows to be raised historically. But as yet, if you take a look at the UEFA rules, there appears to be nothing which specifically looks at the transfer of registrations in terms of the prices which are being paid. I think if you recall recently, we spoke about the transfer or the potential transfer of Arthur from Barcelona, I think it was to Milan, and the prices there, because it was a player swap, those prices both looked high, but it allowed both clubs to report a profit on the deal. Yeah. If we take a look at multi-club ownership, I think Manchester City and the transfer of Aaron Moy is a classic example of eyebrows shooting up. Aaron Moy was part of Melbourne City. He was then signed on a free transfer by Manchester City. His career there lasted 6 days before he went out to Huddersfield Town. So Manchester City got a loan fee for a player who'd only been with them for a week and who cost them nothing. And then 12 months later, Aaron Moy was sold for somewhere between £8 to £10 million to Huddersfield Town. So, you know, the cynics and the critics, and you know, I don't have a dog in this particular fight. I'm just reporting my perception of what has happened. That the critics will say, well, City have organised this, or rather the City Group have organised this in such a way that the profits are taking place in Manchester City's accounts because they're the club who are most at risk in terms of financial fair play. And there are also, if you recall, Frank Lampard with Manchester City and New York City, that caused a bit of a stink at the time because nobody was quite sure where Frank was registered for a while.
Yeah, you did have a dog in this particular fight, but he's just legged it with your trainer, isn't he? Also, Aaron Moy plays for Brighton, so you do sort of have a dog in the fight, Kieran. Simon Dorset is challenging John Castle for the week's longest question. Simon, I have subbed it a little because I kept getting lost halfway through. I had to leave a trail of crumbs during one attempt to write this question down. But it is, it's a very interesting question, and it's about Reading. And Reading are one of those clubs, Kieran, that without ever ringing alarm bells, crops up every 4 or 5 weeks with a question that makes you go, this seems very interesting. And here's Simon's question. Simon says, and he's a fan, Reading seems to have avoided breaching FFP over the last three seasons by a significant one-off transactions. So in 2016-17, loans of over £9 million were written off. The following season was boosted by a £6.5 million profit on the sale of the stadium. Then last season, Reading sold the training ground to the same company that bought the stadium. This season, they've issued 23.2 million shares at £52.35 per share to generate just over £12 million income. Now, will that share issue count as revenue for FFP purposes? And finally, he says the loan write-off seems dubious enough as a way of generating revenue, but what's to stop every ambitious owner issuing more shares every season as a way of injecting funds?
Okay, let's deal with these two issues separately. First of all, in terms of debt write-offs, this was the route that Queen's Park Rangers went down in 2014. Their owners wrote off £65 million of debt, and QPR tried to treat this as revenue. That was a very long and protracted case. It took around about 4 years. And in the end, QPR's defence was found to not have worked, and they were given a sanction, although you could argue it effectively cost QPR around about 9 million quid was the present value of the fine, and they benefited from 1 year of being in the Premier League plus 2 years of parachute payment. So they benefited to the tune of 180 million. So I've always been a bit, I think they got off quite lightly with that particular one.
So just remind me, Kieran, we have spoken about this before, but so for that 1 year that they were in the Premier League, the EFL investigation was frozen, presumably, was it? Or did it carry on and they assumed that QPR would eventually come back down anyway?
Well, the charges were levelled at QPR, but the case, yeah, the case took, it took 4 years of protracted negotiation. Yeah, QPR could have been in the Premier League, and the EFL charges would have still stuck,
right?
Because we've seen not only Queen's Park Rangers but also Bournemouth and Leicester City. They've both been fined by the EFL whilst in the Premier League. So there's a sort of a gentleman's agreement between the two organisations, is that if the punishment is a fine, then the Premier League will uphold that. But if the the punishment is a points deduction, the Premier League will not apply that whilst a club is in the Premier League.
Got you. Okay.
So that's the issue with regards to the debt write-off, which was the first of Simon's questions. The second question, in terms of share issues, if you take a look at the profitability and sustainability rules, owners are allowed to put in £24 million over a three-year period in the form of shares, and that will count towards FFP. If they put in any more, it's good from a cash flow point of view, but it doesn't contribute towards your FFP profit.
Okay, right. That's a shorter answer than I was expecting for that long question, but I hope, Simon, that makes sense. Robert Curtis is a Blackpool fan. This is less of a question, Kieran, than a proud statement. But as Blackpool, over the past few years, haven't had many chances to make proud statements, I was happy, actually, to nod this one through. Robert says that Blackpool offered season ticket holders five options with regards to unplayed games at the end of last season. Option number one, leave the money in the club. Option two, donate the five tickets to the NHS and other key workers, so they got the refund. Donate them to local charities. Credit towards next season's ticket, or a pro rata refund. And Robert just wants to know, have any clubs offered as many or more options to their fans? I know Palace offered three, but I can't think of many clubs that have offered more than five. And it's to Blackpool's credit, I presume, that they've done this, Kieran, isn't it?
Yes, I mean, I've looked at a few clubs. I think a few clubs have, some have matched the five options available. Some have offered fewer. What always intrigues me is, what is the default position? So sometimes you'll get an email which says, unless, if we don't hear you from 30 days, we're assuming you're going to give the money back to the club. So it's a case of opting in or opting out being the default position of the club. And I think that says a lot for the integrity of individual clubs, because not everybody checks their email on a regular basis. And also, my experience with dealing with football clubs and their ilk, sometimes my Gmail account will stick things from a football club into the junk folder, because they look like they're a mail out.
Yeah.
And Gmail can be a bit too aggressive at times. So therefore, you miss out on things of this nature.
Mm-hmm. Okay. A broader question comes from Greg Campbell. And Greg says, can Kieran, I'm not going to be insulted by the fact he says, can Kieran, rather than can you, offer any insight into this, Kieran? I'm a bigger man than that. But Greg says, can Kieran offer any insight as to how Scotland compares to other nations around Europe? For example, proportional attendance figures are the highest in Europe, but our TV deal is lower than Denmark and Norway, for example. I said that twice. And he says Scotland has been able to outcompete much larger nations like Sweden and Poland. I mean, some Swedish and Polish fans may disagree with that, Greg. But Greg says, are our finances stronger than those larger nations, or some of those larger nations?
Scotland's an interesting one in that the domestic TV deal, it isn't huge, and certainly some Scottish fans have complained about this. Remember when we had Neil Doncaster on the show last year?
Yeah.
I think he gave a very valid explanation as to, you know, the challenges that face the SPFL. What I think is unique about Scotland is that they've got Celtic and Rangers, and you know, they have average crowds of, you know, just shy and just over 50,000 turning up every week, which is an amazing achievement. Mm. If you take a look at Sweden, the highest average attendances in Sweden are 23,000.
Oh, right.
In Poland, they're only 17,000. So we've got these two Scottish clubs who do generate more income than what you might refer to as their European peer group, you know, the likes of Sweden, Poland, Hungary, and so on. And Over half of both Celtic and Rangers' income comes through match day. So again, I think that's testament to the feverish support that those two clubs get. So that does give them a financial advantage when they are trying to compete for places in the Champions League and the Europa League. So both of those are pluses. As a result of that, those two clubs have been at the forefront to a lesser extent. Yeah, we've had the likes of Aberdeen making some progress in the European leagues and so on. The algorithm that UEFA use, and fortunately this appears to be one that hasn't been used to allocate A levels, does appear to be quite consistent in its operation. And clubs and national institutions, national football associations know exactly what they have to achieve to make progress. So as from next season, for example, Scotland will get two potential places in the Champions League because the SPFL club's record in recent years has put it in the top 15 nations within Europe. So that could be incredibly lucrative for those two clubs. And once you get into that situation, because UEFA money makes such a difference, Celtic were making, when they qualified for the group stages of the Champions League, they were making £30 million a year simply from that alone. That can be sort of creates a virtuous circle and becomes self-fulfilling.
Thank you, Kieran, on behalf of Greg. Jacob Frick has asked us a question. Jacob Frick is an American who is fascinated by football, but he says except for his university team, Jacob had no team to support. So, based on your podcast, I decided to pick a lower league team in England. I now own a Hereford FC shirt solely because I like their crest. Well, it is a very handsome bull with very kind eyes. And Jacob says, I discovered that they are a Phoenix club. How does that work financially? Do they have any fiscal connection to the old club? Do they have to buy the rights to the crest, the name, etc.? And before you answer this, Kieran, I'll let Jacob into a little secret. As you probably know, Jacob, if you listen to the pod regularly, I don't believe that anybody should have any affection whatsoever for a second team. I believe that when you're born, your place of birth and the place of your local football team should be registered at the same time. And when you're older, you have to support that team, even if it means getting tattooed at the age of 10 to remind you. But as it happens, my wife's dad, God rest his soul, his last church circuit as a Methodist minister was in Hereford. So I spent a lot of time there, became friendly with some Hereford fans, went to a lot of games. And if I have to ever admit to having a soft spot for another team, it is Hereford. So I'm with you there. But Kieran, it would be interesting because we do talk a lot about Phoenix clubs and how successful they can be and how much fun they can be for fans of the old club. But I'd never actually thought about how it does work financially, especially that idea of buying the right to the name, the crest, etc.
Well, you're absolutely right, Kevin. So Hereford United FC were wound up in 2014. They were subject to litigation from HMRC, from a former owner, from a former manager for non-payment of wages and things of this nature. There was an ill-fated takeover in 2014 by a bloke called Tommy Agombar. Tony was best described colourfully as an entrepreneur. And upon further investigation, it turns out that he bought Hereford United Football Club for £2. Now, that's a price of football. You know, that gets our alarm bells ringing.
Yeah, yeah.
And then it turned out that he had spent some time indoors for lorry theft. Now, as you know, I've got no issue with people doing time. I am indebted to HMRC, for members of my family for keeping them safe from safe from temptation by locking them up in the past. But as a result of that, Tommy failed the owners and directors test. There were issues with some of his associates, I think it's fair to say, and the Hereford United fans started to boycott the club with the consequence that crowds dropped from, you know, Hereford used to get fantastic crowds.
Indeed.
Even in non-league.
Indeed.
Crowds dropped to around about 200. So the club was wound up, but this allowed the Hereford United Supporters Trust to create this Phoenix club called Hereford Football Club, as opposed to Hereford United.
Yeah.
And they were effectively able to take over, to effectively buy for a pound, I would understand, the crest. And they've also got a lease, I believe, at Edgar Street.
They have, yeah.
So I've been to Hereford United myself. I was there in 1997 for Hereford's final game as a Football League club, and it was without doubt the most emotional 90 minutes of football I've ever observed.
Same for me. I was in the town. I was heartbroken when they didn't relegate you.
Yes, I can imagine. Yes. But since Hereford FC were formed in 2016, they've had three promotions. They're now in the National League North, and a bit like AFC Wimbledon, where a club does have a connection with its local community, which again is very much at the heart of our beliefs on this podcast, it tends to get relatively good support compared to the leagues or the divisions in which it starts. So it can whiz up through those leagues, and it has been quite successful. And I think here is the hope for the likes of Bury AFC, in their ambitions to return to the Football League at some point in time. And equally, I'd like, hope the same happens for Hereford Football Club, because it's a club with history and heritage, or rather it's a town with history and heritage. You and I are both old enough to remember 1972.
You took the words again. You took the words right out of my mouth. I think most football fans of our generation have got a certain soft spot for Hereford, because that was probably the most iconic image of 70s football for me, is them beating Newcastle, then in the First Division, and what seems about 25,000 kids in parkas invading the pitch at the end and falling out of trees was marvellous. But just on that specific, it just interested me. Why Jacob's question interested me particularly was, in fact, about that crest. And, of course, Hereford always associated with the ball. But so in the negotiations to buy the club from the clearly wrong and owner, would things like the rights to the crest, would they, when you talk about a supporters group buying a club for a pound, I mean, are we still talking about contracts that are 150 pages long here, or are we just literally talking about, right, I don't want it anymore, it's yours? I mean, so crest images, are they still involved when a Phoenix club does that?
Yes, because the intellectual property in relation to the old crest rests with Hereford United Football Club. Now, the person, effectively the liquidator of the club, there's no other takers, so he or she's going to take the best price available, and you sell the whole thing as a package. So it would be a reasonably long legal document just really to list out the assets which are being acquired, because there could be other assets, or the assets themselves could have charges against them. They could be leased and rented. So what the liquidator or the insolvency practitioner would do is to establish ownership of individual assets. I remember when I was running a narrowboat holiday company here in the UK, which had gone bust, and what the owner had done, which I did admire in a way, was that he'd taken out mortgages on the boat. So if he had a boat, let's say he had a boat called Arkansas, he would go to Barclays Bank and say, well, this boat is worth 50 grand. Will you give me a 30 grand mortgage on it? Barclays would send somebody down, do a quick valuation. Yeah, we'll lend you money. And then what this bloke did was that he unscrewed the nameplate to the boat, and he says, right, I've now, and then he stuck on a new nameplate with Wyoming on it. And he did this with four or five times. So when the company went bust, I was doing this list of boats. I go, well, there's 46 mortgages and we've only got 21 boats, and trying to work out what went on. And then the bloke said, I'm just a, going away for the weekend with the missus, and he caught a flight to Bolivia. So I had to go and clear up the mess on that particular one. But these things can get messy, which shows you really have to do your paperwork very carefully.
Yeah, plus I believe he also made the mistake of paying Alan Partridge too much for the advertising deal. Tony, that's I often wonder in my every antenna in my body stiffens. Well, I should have said that, should I? When you say I once did, this is like, that's another one to add to the list. Narrowboat owner. Tony Hay. Again, this is one of those things that it seems simple, but we've never really considered it. Tony Hay says, I imagine players at the Premier League will be very nervous at the moment about being loaned from a Premier club to a Championship club or lower that might end up in administration. What happens to loan players at a club like Wigan, for example, if wages go unpaid? Do parent clubs pick up the wages or do they just recall the player?
Right, the player's contract of employment rests with the parent club, and therefore the parent club is obliged to pay him. The way that this works out is the club which is effectively renting the player. So if Wigan had loaned a player from, let's say, Liverpool, Wigan pay to Liverpool a monthly fee, which is a contribution towards the wages, as well as the loan fee, which is agreed between the two clubs. So the player himself is always protected in the sense that provided his parent club is trading, then he's got nothing to worry about in terms of going out on loan to a club which might be at a higher risk from a potential insolvency in the lower leagues.
Now, this is probably more of a legal employment question, Kieran, than a financial one. But does a player, is he able to refuse to go on loan? If Palace say, right, you're going on loan and he doesn't want to go on loan, is he able to do that?
Yes, he would be able to turn that down. And there have been examples. So if you take a look at what's happened with Gareth Bale and Real Madrid, I think Real Madrid have tried to loan him to clubs in China and elsewhere in the Middle East. And Gareth Bale has turned around and says, actually, I quite like Madrid as a place to live. I've got a contract of employment here until I think it's 2022. So thanks, but no thanks.
Yeah, see, the trouble with that argument is he does quite like Madrid until Tottenham offer him a fortune and he has to explain why he likes North London better than Madrid. Our penultimate question, not that I'm implying that North London, of course I am, I'm from South London. Why would I not imply that Madrid is better than
North
River,
London? North of the River, Kent, exactly. We're both South boys.
Our penultimate question comes from Mike Wright. And we'd be pleased to know, Kieran, it's regarding your favourite subject, says Mike. Mike, to be fair, there are a lot of favourite subjects that we haven't discussed on this pod. So
I was quite nervous when you said that, Kevin.
For the purposes of this pod, your favourite subject is the selling of stadia to the owners of the club. Would it be possible? And again, it's so simple, this. If he was a criminal mastermind, Mike, the policeman would be going, it's so simple, but we didn't even think of it. Would it be possible to sell the stadium back to the club for £1 and then rebuy it off the club for £80 million to help with FFP again?
Conceptually, yes, it would be possible. But if you take a look at the EFL rules, it says that if clubs do sell assets, they've got to be at what's referred to as fair value. Now, if Derby County, for example, have sold Pride Park for £80 million to another company owned by Mel Morris, who's the Derby owner, he's got to be able to prove that £80 million is a fair market price. If a year later he sells it for £1, that would indicate that the first transaction was not a fair value. I think from an EFL charge point of view, that might come unstuck. And I think one of the issues which I did pick up from the Sheffield Wednesday EFL ruling was there appeared to be no concern, as far as the EFL were concerned, that the sale of Hillsborough for £60 million was at an artificially high value. And that could actually be some consolation for Derby County, because they are still presently on a charge from the EFL with regards to their stadium sale. And that case, it should be due out in the next week or two.
Okay, we'll probably have another chat with Tom Horton, not QC, after that then. Our final question comes from Paul Patrick. Paul says, how does my club, Cliftonville of Belfast, survive financially? Are there ways we could do better? I know we're a minnow in the scheme of things, but I'd be interested in your perspective. Paul, in the scheme of things, there are no minnows on this pod. Cliftonville, every bit as important as Barcelona, as far as we're concerned. You support the oldest club in Ireland, Paul. Stand straight and tall. Be proud. But how does Cliftonville survive financially, Kieran?
Okay. Well, first of all, they publish abbreviated accounts. So I'm on my soapbox. I'm now off my soapbox. So I don't know the details in terms of their profitability. But if we take a look at 2019, they did make a profit of around about 19 grand. They do have cash in the bank. What's really important from Cliftonville's perspective is qualifying for the Europa League, even getting as far as the preliminary rounds. And I think they lost 6-1 on aggregate in 2019-20, but they did get there. That was worth around about 200K to the club as far as the distributions from UEFA are concerned. And one of the things, you know, I've got to give UEFA a lot of credit for is that they do try to get money to clubs in the smaller nations through routes such as this, and that's got to be applauded. I mean, Cliftonville's average attendance is 1,200, which is none too shabby. I took a look at their balance sheet overall, and I think they run themselves. They run a pretty tight ship. They don't overextend themselves. You know, from what I could see, you know, in a non-COVID world, I would say that they're a pretty pretty well-run club.
Oh well, that's good news for Paul. And it illustrates as well, if you do have any questions about your club at whatever level, we are always happy to ask them, because you can, there's no limit to how low Kieran will go in many, many areas. But Kieran will find out anything about a club at any level. So please don't be shy or think that the rest of the world won't be interested in your club at your level or your nation, because we are. Football is a very broad global church, and we're happy to discuss it at every level. So if you do have questions about your club, it's questions@priceoffootball.com. I'd like to say thank you for all the people who sent questions in this week. They're very good, very interesting, as always. Kieran, I hope the Baroness has the rest of a lovely weekend with the wine that's been delivered. I hope the dog brings your training shoe back, because you can't go training. You can't drive your Audi TT with just one shoe on, Kieran, can you?
Certainly not.
And do you have a message for our listeners, Kieran?
Well, I'd just like to say again, echo what Kevin said. Thank you for all the questions. Thank you for the feedback. It does keep us on our toes. If you could bang that big purple icon thing on the Apple podcast app and give us a review. It's not for our ego. You can say eyebrow-raising stuff. You can say not as good as the Swiss Ramble. We're not bothered about what you say. But according to producer Guy, it does make a difference as far as trying to keep our head above the water financially in terms of putting on the production costs for the pod. And other than that, folks, stay safe and look after yourselves.
Yeah. Take care, everybody. Bye-bye. The Price of Football. Price of Football.